We said, ask us anything, and now we are responding. In this Q&A episode, we answer a few of the top questions we receive from our listeners. We dive into what implantation bleeding looks like, the pros and cons of IUDs and vasectomies, Phexxi, birth control and its impact on the vagina, anxiety in the first trimester, chronic constipation in kids, and how to raise progesterone and testosterone. We share our real-life, vulnerable answers to some of these questions and, as always, aim to help teach and empower you along your journey on becoming or being a mother, wherever you land on that spectrum. So without any more delay, let's get started. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about.
And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Starting a new series this time around, which is that every once in a while, we're going to have a Q&A episode where we've asked you on Instagram to write in any questions that you have for us that are maybe just not a topic that's long enough to dedicate an entire episode to, but take a little bit longer to answer than a quick, you know, DM back. And so we're just going to do it here. And it's really free for all. It could be about us. It could be about, you know, medicine. It could be about fertility, postpartum, children, thoughts on the world, anything, our favorite colors, et cetera. No, I'm kidding. But anything you guys want to know. So this is the first of those Q&A sessions. And keep looking out for the box. We'll post it every couple of weeks. Or if you have a dying, burning question that you want to submit for this particular kind of podcast, you can DM it to us and hopefully we see it. Sometimes we get a little bogged down by those. But okay, so here we go. Let's start with the first question. What does implantation bleeding look like? All right, I'm going to just go ahead and jump in and I'm going to make a fictitious character who has a perfect 28-day cycle. And she also happens to ovulate on day 14 just to make it easy. So when you ovulate, if you've been having sex prior to ovulation, a couple days, you know, sperm can live up to 5 days in the tract. And so say you had sex on day, I don't know, 11, 12, something like that. Now you have sperm up there. The egg is going to come down into your fallopian tubes, be met with a barrage of sperm. One of them will burrow deep inside of her. And now this will become your fertilized egg. That happens around, that day 14, 15. Then that ball of, it's called a blastocyst, first I think it's a morula, but whatever, we don't need to go there. It's traveling down the fallopian tubes. And it's dividing, it's making some of those first developmental movements, and it still hasn't implanted into your uterus though.
Right.
Once it drops down into the uterus, it still kind of rolls around for up to a couple of days looking for a perfect place to implant. It's very smart. It's looking for all these chemical cues of what's good, what's bad, whatever. It also needs to be a certain stage of development before it can implant. So all of that is happening. When it implants, this is between days 3 to 5 or 6 post-ovulation. So it's like a week. I mean, it's up to a week after you've ovulated that now this thing is finally going to burrow into your uterus. So when it does that, it might cause a little bit of bleeding because it's affecting the wall of your uterine lining that is nice and rich and thick and, you know, would become the period blood if you didn't become pregnant. So it can cause a little bit of spotting. It would be something like either pink discharge, brown discharge, or maybe a drop or two of bright red blood. But it's not going to be more than that. It's not going to be a period. There's no clots. There's not going to be any kind of like significant bleeding to it. Sometimes it can, I mean, rarely, it can be a little bit more than that. And people sort of mistake it for a period. Mm-hmm. And then they go on to not know that they're pregnant. And that can happen too, especially if you're used to really, really light periods. But most of the time, that's not the case. And also, I would say it's not all that common to even see or notice implantation bleeding, but it can happen. You also may have a little bit of cramping. But don't think that nothing is happening or that it's not happening correctly if you don't see or feel these things, because like I said, it's more common to not, I would say, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. I would say a lot of people don't notice that they have implantation unless you're very sensitive to your body and you just feel every single little thing, even though some people will swear that they feel implantation and they don't end up being pregnant. So it's really hard to know. But The other thing I wanted to mention is just if you don't know exactly when you ovulate or you have a slightly off cycle, you might not realize if there's bleeding that is happening a little bit later after implantation, let's say around the time you would actually normally get your period. Sometimes people don't realize they're pregnant. Obviously, if they haven't been trying, that would be more of a mistake that you'd make. If you've been trying, you would probably take a pregnancy test at this point. But if you're seeing more significant bleeding than just a few spots or pink discharge, definitely go see your doctor. Some people can't get in to see their doctor that early, but you know, do the best you can to try to see somebody. The other thing that you can do is check your progesterone, and you can even do this on your own with labs like Ulta Labs, and make sure that your progesterone is high enough. If you want to know the optimal levels, I have an optimal lab range guide to see that. But sometimes if you have low progesterone in those early weeks, it can actually cause bleeding that looks a little bit more like a period. And that could be a sign that you might miscarry. And obviously you can save the baby if it is purely a progesterone issue. So it can be confusing for some people because they might just write that off as implantation bleeding. But if it's like pretty significant or more blood, then definitely take a pregnancy test. And if you're positive, you know, check your progesterone if it's later on in that time. Otherwise, just a few spots here and there is totally normal and probably implantation bleeding, or it could just be a normal variation of pregnancy, which happens all the time.
Yeah. And so even if you, let's just pretend you see implantation bleeding on day 21 of your cycle. So it's been about a week post-ovulation, you may not still get a positive test. Mm-hmm. You may notice a little cramp and a little implantation bleeding and be like, this is really on track and on par for me getting pregnant. Why is the test negative? Because it's implanting and then the little processes that are going on, actually big processes, have still not produced and accumulated enough HCG, mm-hmm. and your ovaries are creating a lot of hormones here, and it just hasn't built up in your system yet to be high enough to then be dumping into your urine at levels that are high enough to then be able to be detected on these tests.
Yes.
So just give it a couple more days. You know, if you test negative again, give it a couple more days. You can test again. You can see if you missed your period, whatever. You know, there's lots of different ways to do this. But sometimes people will ovulate and then 2 or 3 days later take a pregnancy test. And it's just, it has not been enough time. Yeah. That's why on the box of, you know, first response tests and things, you'll see that it says, you know, it can detect that you're pregnant up to 6 days before your missed period. And that's on the earliest end. I mean, yes, a blood test would be more sensitive if you were really, really trying to want to know, but we just have to be cognizant that all of this process takes time and it's okay. Mm-hmm. And eventually you're going to find out. It's really difficult to wait though. I've been that person where I've obsessively tested like every day, you know, at 8 days past ovulation, like, when is it going to happen? And so anyways, that's that. Okay, let's go on. How about IUD pros and cons? Go for it, Leah.
Okay, so IUD is a form of birth control. When we look at birth control, there are lots of different approaches to this. There's female and male birth control. There's barrier methods, which is basically putting a barrier between the sperm and you. There are hormonal forms of birth control, which work to affect ovulation or thin the uterine lining using synthetic hormones. There's obviously fertility awareness method type of birth controls where you track your cycle. So there's lots of forms of birth control. In the birth control world, in the hormonal world, there are lots of forms that those hormones can take. You can take them orally. Some people have rings. Some people have implants or injections. The IUD comes in a hormonal option. So it is one of the routes of hormonal birth control, or there is a non-hormonal option, which is the copper IUD. So that is a form of birth control that is not using any hormones. So I'll just break both of them down, because just to say IUD, you kind of have to designate the two. So in the hormonal IUD world, this is typically a option that does not have estrogen in it. A combo pill, a typical birth control pill, has estrogen. The ring, you know, has estrogen. And so if you choose a hormonal IUD, it's only going to have progestin, which is a synthetic form of progesterone, not estrogen, which can be a pro for some people because estrogen is typically the one that has a pretty strong side effect profile, you know, clot risks, these kind of things. However, it does still have progestin, which also can cause certain side effects for people that don't make them feel very good. The progestin alone can be enough to stop ovulation for some women. And if you are not ovulating, then oftentimes some people feel better because if they have some sort of significant hormonal issue like endometriosis, not ovulating makes them feel better because they aren't producing their estrogen every month through ovulation. And that's what leads to flare their symptoms. So sometimes women with endometriosis in particular feel better on something like the hormonal IUD because it kind of dampens their hormones. Other women feel worse because they feel good when they have the surge of estrogen and the surge of their testosterone to have a libido, and they get their progesterone that comes from ovulation that helps with anxiety and helps with sleep. So if you have stopped ovulation, you don't get any of those beautiful hormonal pictures. However, if your hormonal picture is horrible, you know, this is where some people are like, I felt great on this birth control, and another person says, I felt horrible. So it kind of depends on who you are, is whether you see that as a pro or con. The whole intention of the hormonal IUD is that it thins the uterine lining. And for some women, this is a pro because it makes you have, if you still are ovulating, it would make you have a lighter period. If the IUD stops your ovulation altogether, you won't have any periods. So some women who go on the hormonal IUD stop having periods altogether. Some women see that as a pro. Some women see that as a con because they're never creating a uterine lining and shedding. You know, they don't know how to kind of track their emotions. And some women just don't feel as womanly when they don't have a period. Some women love not getting a period. So again, that's a pro and con that's personal. The hormonal IUD definitely, like I said, can cause side effects for some women. And this is very personal as to whether it's going to cause issues with cramping or mood issues. The thing to note again is if you aren't ovulating, you aren't going to make progesterone. And progesterone is a calming, anti-anxiety, sleep-supporting hormone. So if you aren't making progesterone, sometimes women will experience more anxiety, more sleep disturbance, feeling just like revved up all the time, and they just feel kind of crazy. So if for someone taking hormonal birth control, if they feel like that, then that's probably not a good fit for you. And you need that progesterone, that natural progesterone. Progestin, the fake progesterone in the IUD, does not act the same. It does not help with anxiety and sleep.
That's a really good distinction. And something I've also heard about from women who have the hormonal IUD is that they still sometimes will have this sort of like fake period of time with symptoms, but it will last like 2 weeks.
Yes.
Okay, where they're so like, let me tell you, floaty, and they're like moody, and they're like, oh, I'm on my fake period, but it's almost, there's no blood or very little blood, but it's like way longer than it would be if you just had a normal period.
Yeah. And that can happen for two things can happen. One is you can actually still have the hormonal rhythms of ovulation, but it's thinning your uterine lining so much that you don't actually bleed. So you can still kind of have a rhythmic type of period, but you aren't having blood because it's thinned your uterine lining so much that there's nothing to bleed. Or sometimes women will have it so that they're not ovulating, but enough hormones build up. This is less common with the IUDs, but it can happen, where you're not ovulating, so you actually don't get this hormonal trigger of every month there's like a shed and a rebuild and a shed and a rebuild of the uterine lining. And the uterine lining is what becomes your period blood. But over time, enough builds up to the point where you're not actually having a true ovulation and period, but there's just so much there that eventually it kind of just comes crashing down. Oh. And then you have this really long, drawn out bleeding where you're like, I'm bleeding all of the time, like, or for a very long time. It doesn't even seem like a normal period, and it's very erratic and sporadic. And sometimes that means that you are having anovulatory bleeding, meaning you're not ovulating, but you're still bleeding because that uterine lining is basically being shed because it just can't hold itself anymore. So it can be kind of tricky, and it can be tricky to distinguish the two. So those are some things that can happen with the hormonal IUD. I've definitely, you know, prescribed them or recommended them for patients in certain situations, but I would say only in extreme cases like endo do I see people like really love them. But they are a better choice in my opinion than like the oral pill, and definitely better than the injection or, you know, the implant.
Implant. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the other side, the non-hormonal copper IUD, the pros here is that it doesn't have any hormones. So it is both IUDs are very effective at preventing pregnancy. So that's a good thing if you really don't want to be pregnant. You know, some people are using birth control. Let's say they're married, they're not quite ready for kids yet, but they aren't like trying, and they would be okay if it happened, you know, fertility awareness method or pull out method or something is a maybe better option for them. But someone who's like, I am 100% sure I do not want a child right now, whether before having kids or after, then IUDs are good choices. So the copper IUD is a non-hormonal, very effective form of birth control without hormones. So you will still ovulate, hopefully, as long as your hormones are balanced. And so you will still get all of the same, you know, hormonal rhythms of your period. You will have a bleed and a period. However, the copper IUD has copper and it causes inflammation in the uterus. This is partly how it works. It doesn't allow an embryo to implant because it's so inflamed. And the copper itself is spermicidal, so it kind of kills the sperm. So with that, a lot of women can experience heavier periods, more painful cramps because it's inflamed. You know, your uterus is inflamed and inflammation is what leads to cramps and pain. And so heavier periods, more painful periods can happen on the copper IUD. So you're not getting the hormonal suppression, but for some women, they get more extreme periods. And you would need to be definitely taking zinc if you are on the copper IUD, because copper and zinc compete and you can deplete your zinc stores if you have that much copper. However, some women feel okay on the copper IUD. I personally had heavy and painful periods, got on the copper IUD and felt better on it for some weird reason. It almost killed my sister, you know, and we're related. So it's really hard to guess who's going to feel good on it or not. It's sort of something you have to try and see how it works for you. And both IUDs will be discomfort, or you'll have discomfort when you insert them, and it should, you know, last for just a few weeks. But if it persists for much longer, then there's an issue. But for some women, they see that as a con, you know, that it's obviously a more painful version of birth control than, you know, a patch or something like that.
Yeah, for me, it made my cycles like 9 days long, super heavy, and I'd never had cramps before I had the copper IUD in. And as soon as I got it out, I also went back to not having cramps. That's but great. I was just like, man, I kept waiting, yeah, because they said, well, allow your body to adjust to it for 3 months. So I did that, and then all of a sudden it was 9 months later and a year later, and nothing was really changing. And I don't know, it just, for some reason, and I don't really have any menstrual issues, but isn't that funny? Because you tend to be very, very sensitive, and I tend not to be sensitive. And I remember how you like really didn't have any, you weren't fazed by it. And then our other friend in school seemed to really notice the copper, like overload zinc deficiency symptoms. And it's just, it's interesting. It's something that, you know, if preventing pregnancy and you don't want to take the risk of fertility awareness method, IUDs are probably a better choice. I mean, condoms would be, you know, secondary to fertility awareness method, and then probably IUDs. And so there is a time and a place.
Yeah.
It's tricky. It's tricky. Yep, okay.
It is tricky. There's no perfect birth control.
Nope. That's hear ye to that sentence. Okay. So here's another one. So I'm dealing with first trimester anxiety. I'm at 5 weeks and a handful of days, and it's rough. Okay. Well, first of all, congratulations to you. Second of all, sorry. That is hard. So without knowing more about your case, it's difficult to fully answer. But if you're having anxiety about, you know, being pregnant or losing the baby or something like that, you know, I see you, I hear you. It's a really weird time. The first trimester is so odd. You just kind of hope, you wake up every day and you go, I am pregnant today. And that's all I know. And I hope that this baby develops normally and everything goes well. It's a really big practice in surrender and handing that over to someone. If you're really struggling with it, you know, you can maybe look into homeopathy or some herbs to help with your, calm your nerves, talk therapy, et cetera, different things like that. But if you're having physiological anxiety that you didn't have before, and you're not really all that worried about the pregnancy itself or losing the baby, but you're just feeling like, wow, I am just like riddled with anxiety. This is so odd. It may be a blood sugar issue. Now, in the first trimester, very rapidly, and things start to happen and kick off immediately. Your insulin can increase up to 15 times. Insulin is the molecule that brings glucose, so the sugar in your blood, into the cells. So if you have a lot more insulin, you're going to be gobbling up all of the sugar in your bloodstream quicker and faster and at a really high, consistent, constant rate. And so you need to be eating a lot. So your blood sugar might be having like trillions of dips all day long, and it really doesn't feel good. When your blood sugar dips, and we talk about this in the postpartum anxiety and depression episode, it's actually a really great one to listen to for this because it's a lot of overlap. When your blood sugar drops, your body releases something called cortisol, which goes to your liver to help release some of your long-term storage of glucose so that you can stabilize your blood sugar, because your brain and organs need a consistent blood sugar in order to function. And so this is a very, very sensitive process in your body that's well attuned to survival and life. Otherwise it wouldn't be. And so along with the cortisol, though, is also released epinephrine, adrenaline, you know, hormones that don't make you feel all that great sometimes. And so it could be a blood sugar issue. My suggestion would be to get on top of that as much as you can. Now, nausea is another factor you didn't mention, but maybe that's going to happen in the next coming weeks as HCG continues to rise until 9 weeks, then it begins to drop back off. 9 weeks is usually the peak of nausea for most people due to that hormone. And so eating small snacks of protein and fat and carbs, of course, too, every couple of hours and sort of forcing yourself to eat them. Because if you also get into this like nausea cycle where you're feeling more nauseous because now you have like some low blood sugar in and of itself can make you feel nauseous, then you're going to never be able to get on top of it. Similarly, electrolytes, if you can never get on top of feeling balance with your electrolytes, you're going to be more nauseous. And if you have vomiting now on top of this, do you see how there's so many cycles? If we can wake up in the morning, immediately eat, stay well hydrated, get some electrolyte packets. I really like Element or Redmond's Real Salt makes some different ones, or Needed has some electrolyte powders. I love Needed. And I have yet to try that. I'm excited to try it.
They're so good. I actually have them in my water right now.
Right now. Perfect. Yeah. Oh. Is it salty? I like the salty ones personally.
Element is definitely more salty. I like Needed because it's less like intensely salty, but you can always add like a little bit of salt to it if you really want it to be salty.
Or it's kind of nice to have. Oh, go ahead.
I just love the flavor of theirs, you know.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, I'm going to try it here soon. And I think it's also nice to have an option for like day to day and then an option for when you are sweating more. Like you've been in the sauna or something like that. Maybe Element's better for that. But anyways, that would be my suggestion to you, is to look into those kinds of physiological processes that could be going on to contribute to your anxiety. Homeopathy is a wonderful medicine for pregnancy because it's completely safe.
Yeah, I was going to say homeopathy would be so good.
Yes. And
So safe and so powerful.
Yes, it can be amazing. So either you can work with a homeopath or a naturopathic doctor who knows it, or you can even just begin searching around online, type into like Google, type in homeopathic
remedies for anxiety.
Yes. Yep. And then just start reading through some of the profiles, and you may not find it on those first couple articles. Keep going. You'll find something that you're like, that's me. That sounds exactly like me. Go ahead, go try it. See what happens. You know, give it a couple of weeks. When it works, it's like it's amazing. It's just the only thing is that if you choose the wrong remedy for your state of being, nothing is going to happen at all.
Right.
So when you get the whole right point remedy,
for anyone who doesn't know, we should probably just mention when choosing a homeopathic remedy, the remedies all have a characteristic to them of how they would present, and we don't have to get into all of like the details of it, but basically you want to read their profiles and pick the remedy that most matches how you are showing up or expressing your anxiety. So four people could come to us all that say they have anxiety, but they all present very differently. And what makes it better or worse, how they actually are in a day, you know, my anxiety is worse in the morning and it's better when I go outside and get fresh air, or, you know, well, what are you thinking about with your anxiety? Well, I just keep thinking about, you know, something really bad happening to my partner, and I see it in my eyes, like a movie, like his heart crashing, you know, like all of these specifics. Each person would be different, and each remedy helps support a different aspect of that. So the key is to pick the remedy that matches what you are experiencing.
Exactly.
Versus going to Whole Foods and just seeing, oh, this bottle says anxiety on it. That's what I'm going to get. It won't work.
Yeah, that's not going to work. Also, the FDA requires that they like say something on there. So sometimes it's just like the most random. Like, it doesn't even, not even the FDA, like whoever it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on here. These are, okay, let's see. This one's for you. What can help naturally raise progesterone and lower testosterone?
Oh, okay. Well, those are sort of two different things, but no, they're not, you know, that different. Basically, to raise progesterone, progesterone is a hormone that is made when you ovulate. The egg that gets ovulated, around the outside of it has the corpus luteum. And that produces progesterone after ovulation. The health of your eggs and the health of the follicles that are the home to the egg, so all of your eggs are held in little cases that are called follicles, the health of those determine the health of the tissue of your corpus luteum, which can determine the health of your progesterone production. So to increase progesterone, you actually need to think back about 3 to 4 months before ovulation. Obviously, you can't go back in time. So moving forward, make some big lifestyle shifts and changes, all of the same things that we talk about or that you might learn about how to boost egg quality is going to be very helpful in producing more progesterone because the progesterone is made from that egg. So a few things in particular that really affect progesterone are the microbiome is another big place where inflammation can come from. And this one can be a little trickier to support because a lot of times it's not so good bacteria, parasites, or yeasty kind of things in your gut that can be causing issues. So that would be definitely better to work with a naturopathic doctor or somebody who can work with gut health on. Some things that you can do without getting support for the microbiome, boosting your nutrients, making sure that you have all of the adequate nutrients for egg and sperm, or not egg and sperm health. You don't need, let me just start that over.
These can be part of the bloopers.
Making sure that you have the proper nutrients for your egg health, like all of your B vitamins in particular. Magnesium is really important for progesterone, and also reducing stress. Stress is a killer to progesterone. When you are stressed, you produce a hormone called cortisol, and it kind of competes with progesterone production in a way. There's a complex mechanism that happens, but essentially when you're stressed, progesterone often goes down. So boosting your key nutrients, doing all of the things that we teach about for egg quality health, reducing your stress and supporting your inflammation. For testosterone, testosterone is a different hormone. It's produced from a different part of your ovaries in your adrenal glands as well. And this is a little tricky if you have low testosterone because it can be for lots of different reasons. Sometimes it can be because of birth control. If women were on birth control in particular lowers testosterone. Many forms of birth control lower testosterone. Sometimes birth control is prescribed on purpose to lower testosterone when women have PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome. You would know that if you have this, if you have a lot of acne, oily, greasy hair, a really high libido. If you had irregular cycles and maybe you were put on birth control for that as a younger person, that could be a birth control that they put on actually stopped testosterone. However, a lot of women are put on birth control that don't have those issues and it's still reduced testosterone. If that's the case, then it can be a little trickier to bounce back from that. There are things that you can do to lower sex hormone binding globulin, which is the protein that goes up that makes your testosterone go down. Things like boron are very helpful, making sure that you exercise regularly. In general, testosterone is produced when you are sleeping a lot because growth hormone is a precursor to testosterone and that's made in sleep. So make sure you're getting adequate sleep, exercising and lifting weights, in particular large muscle groups like your butt and your legs, are really good at boosting testosterone. And there are herbs that you can take as well, like Damiana. In particular, there's some libido blends that I really like that have a lot of the herbs. In particular, Designs for Health is a company that I love, and they make a libido herbal blend that is really good, and that can help boost testosterone. And then Eleutherococcus or ginseng is a wonderful herb at increasing DHEA, and that can naturally increase testosterone. So that's a complicated question to two different parts, but hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just really highlights how intricate hormones are because you're talking about precursors, you're talking about sleep, and then growth hormone, and then testosterone. And I mean, it's really just like we need to be living our best life as much as we can because it is intricate into all of this stuff.
Yeah, stress and sleep. If you're going to like, what can I do? Get more sleep, go to sleep sooner, reduce your stress, and that will help both of them, all of them.
And then for more support too, in the first part of the question about naturally raising progesterone and egg quality, we do have an egg quality episode that you can check out to get more specifics as well. So, wow, thank you. Okay. So sort of to spin off that, I think it would be a nice transition. That's not exactly the same, but so there's a question about constipation. So it says, struggling with chronic constipation with our three-year-old, how do I determine the root cause? So it just reminded me your answer because my answer to this would be similar in that, okay, so 3 years old constipation. I see this a lot in the clinic when I'm treating the little kiddos, and it can be, there's multiple routes, right? Mm-hmm. But let me just outline them for you. And it may be something that you haven't thought of yet. So are they eating enough fiber and drinking enough water? Does the water have minerals? A lot of people don't know this, but if you have a reverse osmosis filter in your house that's not adding back minerals on its own, because I think very few companies do that, you need to be adding minerals to your water because it will be deplete and devoid. And because of the osmotic balance of water, when it gets into your body, it's going to be pulling minerals from you and your tissues. So you can get something like the Concentrace drops mm-hmm. by Trace Minerals. That's on Amazon. I love them. I recommend them to everybody because it's very cost effective. I highly recommend, little tidbit here, get the 2 ounce bottle, not the 8 ounce bottle, because the 8 ounce bottle, when you go to drop it in, it'll like glug. Whereas the 2 ounce bottle will drip, 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 drip. And you really only need like 3 or 4 drips per like glass of 8 ounce water.
Mm-hmm.
If you do too much, it's going to be like salt water. So, you know, you'll have to play around with it. And especially with kiddos, it's like, okay, so start with 2 drops for them, and they will not notice it. And if they do, I mean, just then go down to 1, because 1 is better than nothing. So anyways, minerals in your water, fiber, are they eating plants? Are they eating vegetables and fruits? Are they eating any of the grains that would then have fiber as well? You know, rice, white rice is pretty devoid, but oats and whole grain breads and, you know, quinoa all have pretty good fiber profiles. So that's a good basis. Then is there a microbiome insult? So you were mentioning microbiome, and it's like, I do stool analyses on kids all the time, and I'm shocked at what I see, because sometimes they've had antibiotics in their history, which will definitely affect things, and sometimes they haven't, but they've picked up on, or maybe inherited through mom or whatever it is, a kind of crappy microbiome, and they've got some infections, staph and strep, they've got high inflammatory markers, or they're reacting to gluten, they're reacting to something else. So speaking of that, it could be that they have a food intolerance, and it's something low level. It's not going to be causing a big anaphylactic reaction. That's IgE. It's not going to be causing even a delayed reaction where it's maybe like a skin rash. It's just causing this slow chronic inflammation in the gut that is then now resulting in slow motility, which is the, you know, act of constipation, whether it's getting too dry, it's not coming out daily, whatever's happening, it's a big ball, et cetera. Also with kiddos, sometimes impaction, which is where the whole entire colon is like full of stool, goes really like sleuth. It's like, you don't know what's happening. They may have some bowel movement every day or every couple of days, and you wouldn't know it. But if it seems like they have a lot of stomach aches, their stomach's really hard, you know, you need to take them in, they need to go get a physical exam. It could be something that's kind of on the outlier, but it's always a possibility. With the microbiome, you know, you could just try probiotics for a little while, see if that helps or changes anything before getting a stool analysis, because they're expensive. I get it. And then, yeah, 3-year-olds might be sort of behaviorally holding. So depending on how potty training went, how it's going, if you're in the process, et cetera. I think I potty trained really well, but I was that kid that did not want to stop playing to go pee or poop. And so at 3, I developed chronic constipation and recurrent UTIs for no other reason than I just would not get my butt off the ground from playing. And it really was frustrating for my parents. And I don't have like strong memories of doing it, but I did. And, you know, taking me to all these tests and taking, you know, Sennacot for years, like horrible things. Anyways, so sometimes kids just need a couple of weeks of magnesium too, to be supplemented, to kind of get things going, to break through any of kind of a behavioral holding where like they really can't hold it back because the magnesium is making it, you know, like an osmotic laxative, like magnesium citrate, which is in the Calm powder, is not going, you can't really hold that back. It's coming. So sometimes we can break through this where they're having a positive experience and a daily bowel movement every day. And then they kind of get over it. You know, it's a phase. So there's lots of different ways to look at this question, but that's kind of my approach, at least in a shotgun approach. Would you have anything to add?
Yeah, no, I think you covered it all. You know, I don't see kiddos personally, but I see adults and similar. You know, if someone has constipation, we're kind of looking at all of the same things. Behavioral holding isn't as much in the adult population, but what I would say is, you know, proper positioning for adults, more, you know, getting a squatty potty and making sure that you can do that, drinking hot lemon water in the morning. That would be more of an adult thing. But just using bitters, that's the other thing, maybe not as much with kiddos if they'll take them, but I see that that really helps. I am just so like root cause. And so you always look at the foundations first, you know, water, food, and then look to what causes other issues, which most of the time, if there's a gut problem, it's a food or microbiome issue. So yeah, but there's so much that you can do to support. All of your tips were great. And also homeopathy. So we mentioned homeopathy, and sometimes, like, if you read, there's a great book that's the Homeopathics for Kids book. And there are some situations, if you read those profiles and you're like, oh my gosh, this remedy sounds just like my child, like outside of their constipation, maybe they're having other behavioral things that are similar. A homeopathic remedy could be super helpful for them, especially if it's not necessarily a frank, you know, gut microbiome issue in particular, and more just something's just not right. Everything else has kind of been looked at. Homeopathy can be really helpful.
Yeah. And to that too, it's never usually like 100% one factor.
Thing, yeah.
Yep. It's sometimes 25% this, 5% that, 40% this. And that kind of adds up to the whole picture. And so all of these things can be helpful. Cool. Okay. Here's one that we haven't actually had any questions about yet that I'm just seeing, which is vasectomies.
Oh, yes. So that is a good question. I used to say that vasectomies were the best option for birth control because there's obviously nothing a woman has to do. It's like the best for a woman. And for a man, I was like, oh, well, if they don't want kids anymore, then whatever, you know, they don't need to have sperm ejaculated every time they have sex. However, there are some risks to vasectomies. And from a Chinese medicine perspective, they really don't like them because they feel that it cuts the energetic chi of the man. And however, I feel like women taking hormonal birth control sort of does a similar thing where it kind of shuts down the feminine chi, or what I call your woman essence. And so, you know, it's doing it surgically, but it is reversible. For a woman, taking hormonal birth control is doing it physiologically, and it is somewhat reversible. So they're similar in that regard, where they're both sort of shutting off the essence that makes a man and a woman, you know, in the traditional heterosexual sense.
In the reproductive sense.
Yeah. The reproductive sense. So yeah, not heterosexual, but just reproductive sense. So the risks are some men can have pain that like lasts ongoing. Some men can have issues, subsequent issues with ejaculation and with sex, you know, ongoing. Some men are totally fine. And that's a risk that you have to take. So again, it depends on your level of intense desire to not have children and how well you can practice the fertility awareness method or use condoms around your fertile window, and how sensitive you are to things like IUDs and hormones. I don't know. My husband has a built-in vasectomy. he was born that way.
Yeah.
So in
maybe
that,
it's Maybelline.
Yeah, maybe it's Maybelline. So in that sense, you know, I'm really like lucky because I get to have the experience of maybe what someone has with having a man with a vasectomy without him having to do it. But we also had infertility, so that's that. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think about the vasectomy?
So a couple of years ago, I was very like, no, we won't do that. I see why other people do, but we won't because of the energetics of it. And then the sperm is still being produced. It's just kind of going off into the ethers. It's like just going into the interstitial space in your body. Does have to fight and kill it. And in some men that produces antibodies and in there's a small increased risk of some cancer. And so it's controversial. You know, some people say, oh no, there's nothing, there's no side effects. And obviously for most people there isn't side effects, but it would be really crappy to have pain or problems with erections or some kind of autoimmune something that happens afterwards. I mean, it's rare. And I think everybody's going to have to reach their point. Now that we have this fourth child on the way, we are thinking about it much more strongly because we have obviously really, really lucky, super duper fertile. He looks at me and I get pregnant. But that's a problem now. And it's a problem now because I do not want five kids. Say we had an accidental fifth. Okay, fine. But then what? I'm only 33. I have a long time that I could get pregnant in the next 10 years, 10 plus years. And I really don't want to be worrying about it. Now, I could be doing the fertility awareness method better than I was, which was that we would still have sex. He would just pull out when around my ovulation, my fertile window. We could use condoms around that time. We probably will do that when I'm postpartum and just sort of see how it goes, see if it feels like something that's you know, sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if it feels like, okay, I like we are done, nailed it in the coffin, done. I don't want to, you know, do anything. I really have no interest in getting an IUD or being on birth control. I wouldn't go on hormonal birth control ever again. Yeah. And the copper IUD, because of my first experience with it, I'm definitely hesitant. Now, that was before I'd had children, and they do say that it's better for uteruses that have had a baby inside of them before. So it could be different for me, but given the inflammation and the copper and the zinc and the like, I really just don't want to. So I can see how people make this choice. I have so many friends around me who their men have had vasectomies and everything is completely fine. And it's like so great. Now, something to know about vasectomies just really quick is that you need to be going to your follow-up appointments where he ejaculates in a cup and they test for the sperm. A lot of women or a lot of men for some reason don't go to those follow-up appointments.
Oh no.
And, or they go to the first one at like 6-8 weeks and say it looks like it's negative, but things can heal. The body's amazing. And especially with reproductive stuff, you know, when there's a will, there's a way. Sperm will make their way. So I also know of many, you know, kind of failed vasectomy babies where things healed up and there was a path and sperm was getting in still. And so then boom. So I would want, if we did it, you know, he would go to all of the follow-up appointments, you know, maybe 12 months out as well, just to continue to ensure it. If you're going to be taking that risk, when you know you're really done and you're like, this cannot happen again. I am not doing this again. And I like, you know, to each his own, but I don't want to get an abortion. So I wouldn't, and I don't want to also like have this child that really puts a burden on us for some other reason. So I don't know. I can see it both ways. I feel like right now, as it is right now, and I'm halfway through my pregnancy, probably he will get one. We'll wait until this baby's like a year. We'll do our thing. And then we'll be like, hey.
Yeah, definitely make him do the checkups because I feel like he's very fertile.
I know. Yes, exactly. So I see how there's cons, but like you said, there's no perfect birth control. And it's just, it's like, at some point the scales have to tip to where your risk benefit ratio lies.
So. Right. It's all about risk benefits with medicine. And the other thing I wanted to point out just for people trying to make the decision is if you are really hesitant or your partner is really hesitant about you not being on birth control because of the condom use, because some people are like, I hate condoms. I will never, you know, and you really want to be able to have sex around your fertile window because that's when your libido is better or whatever. The other thing you could look into is practicing the fertility awareness method with also using Phexxi, which is a new form of birth control that's a pH gel. They're getting more intelligent around birth control with sperm stuff because the cool thing about sperm is that they're always regenerated for a man's whole life. They're very fragile, so they can be killed quite easily, which is why we see so much of infertility, and they can just bounce right back the next month. So there actually is a lot more research going into trying to develop more male birth control that is not working on the hormones, because those have been tried to try to, you know, reduce their hormones, like hormonal birth control for women. And obviously those were nixed right away because men had side effects.
Oh my gosh, can you
lowered
imagine?
Libido. Which is literally what happens to so many women on hormonal birth control, but they didn't even let the study keep going because men were experiencing side effects, which is all birth control does to women. So that's that. But there are things that they're working on to affect the sperm outside of the hormones. So if you wanted to wait and just kind of see what comes out in the next few years, there are some things kind of in the works in the research world coming out that might be less invasive, but still may be effective, where you don't have to use a condom and he doesn't have to get a vasectomy. But again, it would be new and early. So something to just evaluate where you are. And again, like you said, someone who's maybe has two kids is like wishy-washy on if they want more, might choose a very different option than someone who's at like, you know, their max.
I'm max.
Or someone who doesn't ever want children ever, you know, but if that's the case, then you know, you might need to be on something like an IUD or something like that. But there's other options. You don't have to, you know. So that's our birth control.
Okay. And with Phexxi, is it PHEXXI or is it FE? Okay.
PH.
Yeah, that makes sense because it's dealing with the pH. Okay. Here's my gripe. And I have done no research to look into this, but I don't know. Maybe if you have any thoughts or experience with patients so far, is that if we're changing the pH of the vagina.
Yes.
If you maybe have that kind of vagina that I have right now, which is really, really sensitive to almost anything, it can trip you up into a yeast infection, BV, something where there's a pH change and shift.
Okay, yes.
And I'm like, that really freaks me out. Maybe okay, people so aren't having
me,
that problem.
But let me tell you about that. So okay. I haven't used Pexi personally because, like I mentioned, we have built-in birth control now. But I have patients and friends that I know who use it. But I've looked into this. Yes, a vaginal pH actually needs to be to be acidic. So a low pH. Sperm need to be alkaline to survive, which is a high pH. So Fexi is an acidic sperm killer. So
it's just
basically
making it more acidic.
It's making it more acidic, which is actually good for a female's vagina.
Great.
So okay. what
Maybe
is
I'll
good?
Just use it without having sex.
So there are, you know, some women just like with everything can be sensitive to like the ingredients in it or whatever, but it's not that, you know, there's not like crazy bad ingredients. The lubes, I would say in general, are really problematic because they do tend to be more alkaline unless you have a pH appropriate lube. So I don't think Fexi would do anything more than what a traditional lube would do. And if anything, it would be better because it is acidic for the woman.
Okay. That's really good to know. Mm-hmm. I guess I should have looked into which direction
it's okay.
Swung the pH.
And how would you know? You know, it's like unless you
did, yeah, I'm pregnant right now. So
yeah,
it doesn't like matter. You can't get double pregnant.
Exactly.
Okay. And this wraps up our first episode of the Q&A. We have a couple of rollovers that we'll talk about at the next one and continue to put the boxes out. If you guys have any questions that come up in between, you know, direct message us. We'll just keep adding to the list. And if it's a smaller topic, we'll throw them into the Q&A episodes. This cool. is going to be fun. Yeah.
Fun. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for other women to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content.
We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.
Please remember that the ideas and views presented in this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. Now go have a wonderful day. You've got this.